telling you someone else's
picture. I know. Someone else, other people use our music, and we love it. It's a little,
this is our little thing that we do.
Cost me a fortune, but I love it. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Aussie Crafter Sealers Shooting the Shit. I'm Luke. That's Todd. Craig is feeling a little poorly.
He's got the man flu.
The poor dear. He's he's under the weather, and he was fine earlier today. He just decided, no, fuck it, I'm not going to do it anymore. So we are sans crafty, but we have our guest of honour, Darren from Morris Wines, Morris Rutherglen. How are you doing?
Well, let's face it, Darren's going to be a lot more interesting to talk to.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
I hope so.
We can do without crafty, really. He's surplus to requirements most of the time.
Yeah. But he does do one or two things, but
That's it. So thank you for joining us, Darren. Lovely to meet you. I don't think I've actually met you properly before. We may have passed at the last Corowa, not this Corowa, but previous one, last year's one.
Possibly
there. I did drop into the cellar door to sample your wares, and I did actually walk away with the bottle as well.
Excellent. That's good to hear.
How
recently were you up there?
So I was down in Corowa for last year's Whiskey on the Murray.
Okay. So, yeah, we must have passed in, like, ships in the night, but...
Yeah, I think so. And then I wasn't at this year's Whiskey on the Murray because I was, I was over in the UK and Scotland.
It's hardly an excuse. Should have come to Corowa.
I probably should have. Yeah. Anyway. So I did miss it this year. And I do have family in Rutherglen as well.
So there's a really good excuse to come up and visit your family in Rutherglen.
Do I like that family?
There's still a good excuse. So we've literally just finished doing our new renovation on our cellar door.
Right.
It's finally finished after all the wet weather and a lot of struggle. So, yeah, please come up, come and see us because it's changed a lot. You won't recognize the place.
So when we were there last year, yes, there was a bit of construction going on. So I guess let's get into that in a moment. But first of all, who are you?
Oh, am I? Yeah. Well, normally when I start talking, I actually say, if you need a translator, normally I have somebody who can speak Australian next to me. So they do tell me I've got a slight accent.
Now, I hadn't noticed.
I don't believe I have got an accent. I think it's you lot who do, not me.
I was picking him as Canadian.
Yeah. There's a German.
It could be German.
German. But yeah, so Northern English. Born too long ago now. But this has been my life as alcohol. So I'm a very lucky man in a way. Little bit of my history is... First university, I decided to do environmental science and biology. And I did that as a degree back in the 90s. And when I left, it turned out nobody really cared that much in the 90s about the environment. We thought we'd done a good job by stopping killing whales and things, and it was over. So I actually went on and did postgrad in brewing and distilling and literally got my first job from there. Worked straight from university in the alcohol industry, worked in cider, eventually got transferred to beer and did a lot of work for a large brewing company based in Dublin. I don't need to name, but the beer's black. And of course, Bale's being part of a large spirits group. I got involved in the spirits production side and I ended up doing RTD work, and I went over to the US and lived in the US for a couple of years. And after that, I went and worked for a Dutch company and spent a lot of time troubleshooting breweries and other alcohol plants around Russia and Africa and Asia. And then somebody offered me a job in Australia. And when I checked the list, Australia was the last inhabited continent I hadn't made booze on. So I've still got Antarctica too. But I came down here and we've got a plan for Antarctica. Antarctica is going to be my 60th birthday with an own brew kit. And as long as I can get somebody to drink it on that boat, I'm going to say that's done because it's the closest I'm going to get. Yeah. I came down to Australia and got a great job working in R&D and looking at spirits down here. And obviously then that progressed into when we purchased Morris Wines in 2016 to save it from closing. And the story went from there.
Wow. Mm. So certainly you've seen the whole gamut of the booze industry from, well, certainly a good chunk of the Australian booze industry from its infancy as well. How have you seen change over the last few years in general, other than, of course, the inevitable tax rise every bloody year?
Yeah, and of course the tax over here is killing us. And really needs to be looked at. But the industry has changed as well. The industry has grown up from when I was first in it. And we have got responsibility now, and we are good at the responsible drinking message, which we need to be. It's a really important message. Back in the old days, that might not have been there. The industry as well... The industry as well has changed in the fact that the two big groups got bigger and bigger and bigger. And at board level, it got quite aggressive, shall we say. The lovely thing about the business, what has not changed, though, is at the ground level, the brewers, the distillers, the people who make the booze, still all talk. We still all go out for a drink. And it's still a lovely business to be involved in. Whether the government with its tax increases, whether it will be the same in 20 years' time, whether I'd be saying to my kids, this is the industry to go into, I don't know.
That would be when it's $500 a litre.
Yeah, I mean, $500 a litre
in 20 years' time, it'll be about that.
Yeah.
It'll be sooner than that, won't it?
Yeah, the way it's going.
The way it's going. So obviously, Morris in particular... started off as wine. So you said you bought the winery to save it from closing. Why get into wine at that point?
So 1859, Morris Wine set off. It set off as a fortified winery, supplying wine to the gold miners, and grew and grew and grew in fortified wine. At that time, I'd come down to work for another wine company who wanted to diversify and was diversifying, and we were working on that.
Sorry? In
1845? No, in 2000, I came down in 2012, obviously. 1859, Morris sets off. 2016, it's in difficulty. I'm already down here working for a wine business, and that wine business is Casella. And by a fortunate chance, David Morris, who was the winemaker at the time, fifth generation winemaker, his dad had done John Casella's dad a favour, and the winery was bought to save it. Their previous owners were a big international company. There was no money in fortified wine. They'd had enough, and they'd literally divided it up and were going to sell it off and get rid of the business. And so John stepped in to save it. At that time, I'd already been interested in spirits. Obviously, we'd been looking at Australian whiskey. And one of the things what we always say is, how come when Australians drink, if you drink wine, you're going to drink Australian wine? If you drink beer, you're definitely drinking Australian beer 99% of the time. But when it comes to spirits, you don't drink Australian spirits apart from rum. Most of it isn't. It's American whiskey what's being drunk. And so we'd already been looking at this, and we bought Morris Wines, and I found this fabulous library of fortified wine. Some of it over 100 years old. We've got casks in there over 100 years old, and the wine has been there, just sat there. And there's all these different types of fortified. So it's a full fortified. It makes everything from a pearer to muscat. So I knew I got a fabulous library of wines to get casks ready to finish whiskey. Mm. And when I said this to John, I said, well, we found how we finish the whiskey anyway. And then by pure luck, out the back was an existing 1933 constructed hybrid copper pot still. Mm. Now, the reason it had been built in 1933 and installed in 1941 was to make the fortification spirit to fortify the wines. Back in the 70s, Tarik came along, it was a lot better to buy your spirit in, it was better quality, it was cheaper. So this had fallen out of use. So it was just abandoned. And the pigeons and galahs had had a bit of fun. So we had a bit of cleaning up to do. But we cleaned it up, we restored it. We actually had to split every plate and every column section apart. Number one, because it was too pure a spirit to make whiskey with, because we want those congeners in your whiskey. And we want those carryover, which you wouldn't get with too many plates. But the other thing was, obviously, it was built in 1933. And in 1933, you made gaskets out of things we don't want to use these days. So we sent men in big white suits and we cleaned everything out and we brought her back to life. And we called her Aurora. And the reason we called her Aurora is Aurora is Sleeping Beauty. That's what she was.
There you go.
Still what's making the spirit at the moment.
Wow.
400 litre pot still because of the column. I've altered the number of plates. Obviously, I can't really tell you what I've done to it, but my spirit comes off around 70-72%. And I get about a good 700 litres arts run on a 3,400 litre pot.
Wow. So between the history of the barrels that you've got sitting there, that library of 100-year barrels, this very old still that's just been sitting there effectively derelict for so long, how do you resurrect that besides just a lot of elbow grease? And was it a big job to get it back up and running?
It was
art and
absolutely. And one thing, we're very much into the history, and one thing I can probably say is you could have probably bought something off the shelf a little bit cheaper than what it cost us to restore it.
Yeah, wow.
It's that love and passion and bringing something back to life. And John's very much into that as well. And we literally brought it back to life and we gave some Australian heritage life again. So it was made by Whitehill, who are a producer of wine making material goods. So when you come down to the cellar door, hopefully I'll be there. And I'll take you out and I'll show you actually how we make the fortified wines as well. Because we still do a vintage every year. We still use open concrete waxed fermenters. We still use a basket press. People still dig these out by hand. The normal joke I get is somebody comes around and says, oh, do you think you'll ever make it to the 21st century? And in the back of my head, I'm going, if I can get to the 20th, it would be a start.
So that's fascinating. I've never actually thought about the process of fortifying a wine.
Yes.
Can you?
And it's an amazing process.
Can you talk me through through that process? Actually, sorry, before we launch into that, we forgot to do
what we're drinking.
What we always do at the very start of every episode is what are you drinking? What's in your glass tonight?
Okay, so tonight I've actually poured myself one of my favourites, which is the Morris Muscat. It's finished in barrels that have been had some muscat in them. So and it really comes through. You get a lot of the Christmas cake, you get a lot of the raisins, you get a little bit of sweetness coming through on it. And tonight, unusually, I've mixed it with just sparkling mineral water because I just wanted something just to cut it but leave those flavors there.
Yeah, nice. There you go. Well, we've started, we poured before we started and we haven't quite finished them yet. So we're on the Island Coast whiskey from Tassie. Which is the sherry cask.
Oh, nice.
Read that. This one came in from the Single Malt Whiskey Club subscription. Uh-huh. That was a nice one sitting on my door when I got back from the UK. And then we were actually going to move on to my bottle of Morris as well. So we'll crack into that one very soon. Talk me through the process of fortifying a wine.
Yes. And it does depend on the wine slightly. So a pairer is slightly different, which is sherry, but we have to call it a pairer because of wonderful geographical protection. But if we talk through the real two big famous ones, and especially the Muscat, and the reason I Muscat's one of my favourite is Rutherglen is known for its Muscats, Morris's especially. So Morris's have actually won Best Fortified Winery in the World, which really put everybody, all the Europeans' noses out of joint slightly.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And that's because of our Muscat. But if you think of Muscat and we take Muscat as an example, what you do is you pick your grapes. Now, our vines are over 100 years old. So that means it all has to be hand-picked. Because if you send a machine down, you're going to get more vine than grape. So you don't want to damage your vines. So they're very old. We pick them. They're also very stressed, which increases the flavour in those grapes. They're left that little bit longer till they're really high bomey or sugar level. And they start to raise in a little bit, which gives you a bit of flavour.
Okay.
So brought in, we bring them to a very old paddle crusher, and the reason being it's a little bit softer on the grapes, and they go into one of these open fermenter pits. Actually, they're above ground of the fermenters.
So sorry, you're not stamping on them with your funky feet?
No, that's the only bit. Well, not yet.
Well, that's what got them to the 19th century.
Yeah. Right, okay. So the paddle was one.
And I say not yet, because what happens is they go into this vat.
Yep.
And they're sat there, and we put a bit of yeast in, and for about 24 to 48 hours, it ferments. But what's happening there is a bit of the sugar's turned into alcohol, but you're only going to get 2 or 3% alcohol, 4% maybe. But you're making some of those flavours. You're making those fermentation flavours. The yeast is there. It's got that contact. You've got a little bit of fermentation going on. And then you're going to stop that fermentation. So what we do is we drain off all the juice we can into a pit, a waxed pit, and then this is where the foot content comes in. A guy gets in with a shovel and he shovels those grape skins into a press, and we press the rest of that juice out.
Right.
So now what you've got is a pit full of very sugary, very low alcohol juice.
Right.
Then add sulfur, which is standard in winemaking, and lots of fortification spirit. So you'll bring it up to about 18 to 20%. That obviously kills the yeast instantaneously near enough. And so now you've got a very alcoholic, very sweet liquid. And what we do is we pump that away into the casks. Now, depending what wine it's going to end up with, we work on average ages in fortified wine. So a classic will be about 6 to 8 years. All the way up to an old premium, which might be 20 years. But when I say 20 years, that's an average. So that might have wine in it, which is 50 years old or 60 years old.
Yeah, right.
The older the wine, the less floral notes you have on the wine, but the more those tertiary, dark, Christmas cake, raisin notes you get coming through. And we actually blended a wine for the 160th anniversary, which had wine in it from the 1930s.
Wow.
And you're never allowed to add sugar. You can add as much ethanol through the years as you want to keep it stable, but by law, you're not allowed to add sugar.
Right. So
that sugar you were drinking from that 1930s wine grew in a grape on our vineyards before the Queen was the Queen.
Wow.
Before her dad was king.
that sugar has seen some shit.
Yes, it really has. And I wish it was true, but I always joke that my doctor tells me that sugar over 10 years old has no calories. Unfortunately, that is not true.
Yeah, they all burned off ages ago.
Yeah. Wow, that's fascinating. So when you're doing that initial ferment, that's obviously not fermenting all of the sugar. It's fermenting some of the sugar, and that's on the grape skin as well. So the grape's just been like paddle crushed to open it up, and but not fully pulped. And then that was 24 to 48 hour ferment just to get some alcohol and some fermentation in there.
Some fermentation flavors. Yep. Then you fortify it. So then you take the juice off and then fortify it. And you fortify it once you've taken the juice off, because if you fortified it on the skins, you'd lose more ethanol in the skins.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. So then that waxed pit is just a big concrete pit or a big wooden...
So they're stone, they're actually brick, and then they're skimmed with plaster concrete. And they're over 100 years old themselves. And every year, my guys get the fun job of going in with little flames and melting all the wax off and scraping it all off. And then they spray on new wax and then melt that on and make sure it's smooth. And that happens every year. And the worst thing about that job is you can't do it when it's cold or wet, because you'll get water behind the wax. And then when you get to summer, it will expand and knock the wax off. So we do it in December and January, which are obviously the coolest months at 40 or 41 degrees outside.
Which is generally not really conducive to wax being a solid at that point, is it?
No, but it helps because it runs smooth as well.
Wow, fascinating. So then once you've, what do you do with all the grape skins? And the pulp, once you've squeezed that off, you press that out, you've got all the liquid out, you've got a cake of grape left over. What happens to that?
So what actually happens in a lot of wineries, and I'll talk as an industry, a lot will go to somewhere like Tarrick, where they will extract the alcohol out and it becomes your fortification spirit, because there's alcohol, and they will collect things from like red wine where it's fully fermented out, so you're talking 14-15% at the end. Ourselves, we're so small, our waste is such a small amount. We actually are very lucky that Dave Morris has cattle, and cattle love eating it. We actually use it as a feedstock.
If there's only sort of 3 or 4% alcohol in those skins, they're getting their buzz on.
But remember, it's going to be degrading as well over the time. So, the cows actually eat it. And the old joke in Germany is, if you've got fat cows, the brewery isn't working well. And I can apply the same thing. If the cows are fat, we're not getting enough sugar out of the grapes.
Yeah, right. And then... I always just like the thought of if you feed the cows fermentation waste with a bit of booze in it, then you're going to get some a little bit of alcoholic custard out.
The reason I'm laughing is there is a famous story from Hereford where one of my first ever jobs was in the cider industry. And there's a famous story in Hereford of there used to be orchards, and there used to be mixed orchards, and these apples had dropped and started to ferment in a water bath, natural fermentation. And this farmer rang the local vet up and said, you've got to come out and shunt my cows. For it was the time of BSE, and all these cows were staggering with the terrible BSD disease. And it turned out they hadn't got BSE, they were actually pissed.
So I have just poured us both a glass of the Morris there, which is lovely. Cheers.
So what do you think of that one?
Oh, rich, fruity, and very
it's got a little bit of leather going on, and I'm finding
a bit of leather,
which I like.
I do find it very that the Christmas tree fruits and
yeah.
So I notice it's bottled at 40%. So does that mean that you guys are doing cultural filtering or
on that one? Yes, because it's down at 40%, and the reason it's down at 40%, most of my whiskies are at where they taste the best. Mm-hmm. That one I had to make taste the best down there because I wanted something really approachable. And I've noticed when you drink it, it should just be really smooth, disappear. Yeah. My normal joke is if you have to pull a face when you drink your whiskey, it doesn't mean it's a good whiskey.
That's it. If you have to struggle to get it down. Yeah. I do find occasionally that there will be a whiskey that you've got to think about swallowing.
Yes.
And you know it's going to hurt when you
and
do
you
it.
Know it's going to hurt. It's going to take paint off. You don't have to think about
I'm
that.
I'm an old man now. I'm not into that anymore. I like my whiskey to be really smooth and approachable, and all my whiskeys are, even the higher alcohol ones, the 48-50% ones. But the other thing is, the reason that's 40%, and we discussed it earlier, is talk to the ATO man. And I wanted something where I could put a 700ml Australian whiskey on the market for less than $100.
Yeah.
And I can't do that at high alcohol because the tax means that.
Absolutely. You said that it tastes a lot better than a lot of 40%. There's a lot of flavor in there still,
a lot of volume. By volume, I mean that it has a very thick, oily, luscious mouthfeel to it. There's substance there that it almost feels like it has like a like you can feel the weight of it on your tongue. That it's not just watery. There's a real volume and, and richness to it.
You can actually enjoy it as opposed to just knock it back and get another one.
Absolutely. And as distillers, what I do is I go all the way back, you see. So we're very lucky. So number one, I found all these fabulous fortified wines I can use to get barrels ready and things. But we went and I was very lucky. I got to work with Jim Swan. And he designed my barrel program. And he designed the barrel program for the climate. But then, now you've got a barrel what will work in our climate, which is, let's say, extreme. It's -6, -7 yesterday. And then in summer, it's going to be 41. So I'm getting a massive diurnal shift. But the other thing is, I then went back to the actual spirit. So a lot of it is about balancing your spirit in your barrel. So you know you're going to mature quickly because we're in Australia. So you've got to have the right mix of congeners going into that barrel so that when it does when it does mature quickly, you don't end up with all wood. Because the danger always is you could end up with lots and lots of wood and nothing else. And that's where you start thinking thin and watery. So now we know what we need in our spirit. What your next step then is to look at your fermentation. So then you've got to look at your yeast strains to see how do you get the ester profile you need on the wash going into the wash still to give you the ester profile on the low wines going into the spirit still to give you the ester profile coming out on your spirit. And it's literally balancing all the way through. And I actually use I can't tell you what the blend is, but we actually use a blend of yeast so that
you can get
the right mixture.
Okay. And without going into a lot of detail on the specifics of those yeasts, are they distiller's yeast blended with other specialty ones, or what types of yeasts have you got in there?
Without going for too much detail, one's a really good ester producer and one's a really good alcohol producer.
Yeah, right.
And you do you
co-pitch or are you like starting off with one and then finishing with another? How are you? What's your
co-pitch? Co-pitch and let them fight it out.
It's mine.
And how do you, so with your, with your experimentation on yeast, obviously, if you've got 100 years of history in your barrel store there, there'd be some interesting things going on yeast-wise around there. Have you experimented with wild yeasts or...
Not on the whiskey so far, but yeah, we do make an apera. And we actually use the fleur method. So you get the skim of fleur on top of the wine. And that is absolutely unique to our winery because obviously it is the yeast what's in the atmosphere what caused that fleur.
Yeah, and right. So
the wine, we've done it. I haven't done it on the whiskey yet. But remember, we set off in 2016. I needed to lay some things down so that we could play.
Start paying your way, yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. So since 2016, you've obviously put down a fair few barrels there. What sort of barrels are you reusing those, the huge barrels? Have you got any of those filled?
We've got plenty of the huge barrels. Yeah, we've got plenty of the huge barrels, but they're staying on the wine at the moment.
Yeah, right.
Some of those are over 100 years old, so I can't. And if we put spirit in them, it will be no use for wine anymore. And we've got one built by the Barnawatha Cooperage. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is the Barnawatha Cooperage went bust 105 years ago.
Oh, right. Okay.
Wow.
So you can't get to destroy them. But what we actually do for our maturation, the ones which we work on from Jim Swan are actually ex-wine barrels. Mm-hmm. We're very lucky we own wineries over in the Barossa.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually, when we turn off red wine, I actually get those barrels.
Yep.
However, I don't really like that much red wine in my whiskey. I actually want rid of it. So we actually built a cooperage and we've employed two coopers and their job is shaving back and toasting in the ASTR type barrel. Yep. And so we've got our own cooperage so I can control the barrel toasting regime to a T. And then they come down and we actually fill them with a new spirit and they will do the maturation in those.
Yeah.
And then what they'll do is they'll go into finishing barrels after.
Yeah. Okay. So that cooperage, is that in the Barossa or is that in Rutherglen?
It's actually in the Riverina because that's where all the big winery is.
You spread yourself around, don't you?
We're a little bit spread. So we're one of the biggest in the Riverina, and then we've got Morris's, we've got the Barossa, which is Peter Lehman's, and we've got Bailey's of Glenrowan as well. So we're quite diverse but well spread winery base.
Yeah, fascinating. So with that, the cooperage there, so are they obviously with the winery, you've got a huge need for barrels for the winery. How often are you reusing a barrel in a winery sense?
In the winery sense, they will be filled every time they're emptied.
Yeah, right.
So the big ones, if you imagine, if you send that wine out of the big one to a blend for bottling, it will be backfilled.
Yep.
And it's quite a chase of how do we manage barrels? Because you've got to have space as well, because every year we do a vintage.
Yeah.
We talk about old premium rare Muscat, which won best in the world, like I said, twice. But the thing is, you may have to make 40,000 litres of that to get 2,000 litres. You may make 40,000 litres of Muscat to get 2,000 litres of old premium rare. So it's then how do you manage your volumes through as well?
Yeah. I've always been fascinated with distillery barrel management, and I think we've asked the question a few times of people, how do you manage it? And it's either a case of, well, they're there and I'll look at them, or there's a spreadsheet that has them. How do you manage 100 years worth of barrels?
One of my first jobs when we got down there was cataloging the barrels, because the previous business did it differently. So there's two ways you can do it. The way we do it is we have barrel numbers.
Yeah.
And so we have a computer system which we enter data into, and every time you transfer out, you do a transfer in that computer system and it moves wine from barrel to barrel, so you know what barrel number it's in.
Yep.
The other way, which the other system used to use, was they would make a batch. And then that batch might be split over 20 barrels, but you didn't necessarily know the barrel number. You just knew it was that batch.
Yeah, we put
the individual number. And it's no secret we use, it's a system called Easy. Mm-hmm. And it's just a liquid tracking system. And we use it company-wide.
Yeah,
so right. If you move 20,000 litres of wine from tank A to tank B, you'll have a worksheet and somebody will enter that into the computer and it will physically move in real life and it will move in the computer as well.
Yeah, right. Mm. I guess the majority of the distillers that we're talking to don't have that sort of volume.
Yeah.
And certainly don't have that sort of age.
No.
So the...
and the volume is mainly on the wine side, obviously.
But the knowledge... Because we
have the technology.
That's it. The knowledge and the technology transfer to distilling.
Yes.
Yeah. So moving into creating whiskey, you had the wine, you were doing the fortifieds forever, bringing in spirit to do that. Was it just a brain fart idea that, like, oh, fuck, that the still's out there, we should use it? Or what triggered the move into putting down the first barrels of whiskey?
So, like I said, we were already interested in spirits.
Yeah.
I'd already been looking at equipment. And like I said, it was probably cheaper to buy the equipment.
Yeah.
But when we found this still, you could see in John's eyes, he was just so excited when we could bring this back to life. And it is all about history in the wine. One of the reasons we saved Morrisseys is it was over 160 years old. You can't lose 160 years of Australian wine history. That's a long time in Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's so, almost all of it.
Almost.
You could actually put it that the original family would almost be the first...
would have to be one of the first wineries in the country. You would have...
Pilgrims into that area.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll be growing grapes.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming you're hoping that you'll have a barrel of whiskey sitting there in 100 years' time.
Oh, yes.
90 years' time to go back and have a barrel of your 100-year-old whiskey finished in a 200-year-old musket barrel.
My only fear there is, given my atmosphere, there might be about 2 teaspoons full. we've got some really thirsty angels with those temperatures. But
yeah. So on that, do you know what your angel share is on average, or
on average,
it is quite high?
It depends. It depends on the years. So the last 2 years haven't been too bad because they've been so wet and horrible.
Yep.
But we're still averaging, you can average anywhere between 17 and 22%.
On the whiskey?
Yeah.
On the whiskey side. What sort of an angel share is there on wine and on the fortified wines? Is it much different?
I to be honest, I can't really answer that. So and the reason I can't is I've got a winemaker who would probably know that a lot better than I do. And I've never really looked at his angel share. So.
100-year-old barrel.
Yeah, it's obviously a lot lower.
You're talking about you can actually add extra spirit to it.
You can top up with wine. So you can actually, because it's an average age, it's not like whiskey where you can't things to it.
So now that you've got the still back up and running, for the fortified side of things, are you using that still to create some of your fortifying spirit now?
No.
Is that, would there be like opportunity for special releases or certain ones that are using that?
The issue is, and we've actually got another still as well. So we found the sister still, and we brought the sister still and brought her to life as well, and we called her Ella. Wow. And the again, built in the 30s. So although they're sisters, they're a quarter of an inch difference because they were hand built.
Yeah. Wow.
But both are making whiskey.
Bigger hands than the other guy.
That's it. And the only reason they're still, the problem is we, because I've taken those plates out, the spirit's not actually clean enough to make.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So you'll get congeners in the wine and it doesn't balance. And
yeah, right. It
doesn't mean we won't do some trials.
Yep.
It doesn't mean there isn't trials going on, but it's really hard because fortification spirit normally falls into one or two things. It's either brandy spirit, which is that little bit dirtier, or it's what they call SVR, which is super clean grape spirit. But legally as well, it's got to be grape.
Yeah.
So if you add grape spirit to wine and you sell as a fortified wine, because you stay below a certain percentage alcohol, you're in wet tax. As soon as you add grain spirit, you've suddenly gone into duty. So now your 500 ml bottle of Muscat's going to cost you
a lot more. Right.
A lot more.
Yeah. So from a business point of view, obviously juggling the tax differences there would be an interesting challenge for the accountants.
I'm glad it's all right.
The wine industry's got a big leg up over the spirit industry there, doesn't it?
Not really. Because you've got to remember the raw materials and the time and the way that the grape industry works. It's a lot more expensive to produce wine.
Right.
And I think that's why the wine equalization tax was brought in, so that it was more of a level playing field.
Okay.
Don't get me wrong, I would love spirit tax to be lower. I think spirit tax is ridiculously high. But as a industry, what we need to be doing is bringing the top tax down, not the bottom tax up.
Right.
I agree with that. It should be based on actual standard drinks, something like that.
Yeah. How would you change it if you were in charge? You could wave a magic wand over it, and set the tax rate for it. How would you adjust it? How would you change it?
The love I would
except,
do is
except for having none.
Yeah, I know. But the love I would do is I'd introduce wet on everything.
Yeah.
So whatever you sell as at, you pay a percentage of that price. So if you sell your whiskey at $100 a bottle, you pay $50 tax. If you sell it at $50 a bottle, you pay $25 tax.
That does make a bit of sense. And certainly it levels the playing field, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. It also levels it on quality as well. So I think wet runs at about 26%. Say, let's say 25%. I can't remember off the top of my head. Yeah. So if we say you'll sell a bottle of whiskey at $100, so that's what you're going to charge them, your actual selling price is $125 for this 25% on. But that means you've got to have a good enough quality product to sell at that price.
Yeah.
If you've got something what's not that good quality, yes, you can sell it cheaper. You pay less tax, but people may buy it, but they're knowing they're not getting the same quality product.
Yeah. Because I guess that's the challenge of the Australian industry, and with such a high tax rate on the spirit, everything needs to be more expensive to accommodate that, whether it is good or not. And luckily, the vast majority of Australian spirit is very good. But you can also get stuff that is not good that's still going to cost you $180 for a bottle. And if it's coming in under $100, it's a big challenge to get to that point. So to get that sort of a price point, fuck, that's an achievement. And there's not many Australian distillers that have managed to do that. I can only think of two.
Morris and Starwood.
Yes, yourself and Starwood.
Yes, but again, we're very lucky we control the barrels, so we're not beholden to people buying barrels in. We have our own brewery, so we're not paying extra cost on Wash production, yeah. Where we're quite lucky because we own all the parts of it, and because we had scale in those parts, we could afford to do things that bit bigger. And the bigger you can do things, the more cost-effective scale you bring in.
Economies of scale, absolutely.
Yeah.
So where is...
But the good thing about, if you think about, if you sell... Things what, let's just say, aren't as good at a cheaper price because you can, because the tax isn't forcing you to sell $160. It might taste terrible, but it's not going to drive customers away. Our problem is at the moment in this industry is that there are things out there which don't taste great, but somebody's paid $180 a bottle for it. Are they going to go back and try the next one on the shelf, or are they going to go, well, no, I can pay 70 for scotch and I know it's going to be okay?
Absolutely. It also greatly impacts the ability to for the industry as a whole to export and crack into those export markets. Many challenges. We've just also poured.
Moved on to something else.
We've moved on again. We've poured a little dribble of the Cotswolds that I picked up whilst over in the UK recently. Very nice drop.
Very, very nice drop.
Yeah.
Very nice place is the Cotswolds as well.
Sorry?
Very nice place is the Cotswolds as well.
Gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. And thankfully, I was being driven around whilst I was there because I'd had a few of those. Would you like to taste all of our range of gins, sir? Yes, I would. Would you like to now try all of our range of whiskies, sir? Sure.
You just have to be careful in the Cotswolds, though, for it's where Midsummer was, the idea of Midsummer and all the Midsummer villages came from. And we know what the murder rate is like in Midsummer, so.
Well, yeah, I was there in summer. Didn't die. Awesome. Luckily. Yeah. Beautiful part of the world, though. Oh, my God. Just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
So you've won a few awards.
Yes, a few.
Did you try to, or just happy circumstance?
I always try. The awards show that we did the right thing. So you don't go to win an award. You love winning awards, but it shows that what you did was the right decisions. The way you made it was the right way to make it. And we have been so, so lucky. So, again, this year we've picked up double golds in San Fran on four or five of the products, and we've run platinum and the Consumer's Choice Award. But it just shows you that we're doing something right with the quality. I believe awards, you don't go chasing awards. The awards come by doing the thing right in the first place.
Well, just to rattle off the awards for that one, because it is a long list, starting from the earliest award that's published on your website, being 2021 Gold World Whiskey Masters, Bartester Gold Bartenders Brand Award 2022, London Spirits Competition 2022, Ultimate Spirits Challenge 2022, San Francisco 2022, World Whiskey Masters again, 2022. That was a big year for awards. Yes. You had a couple there. 2023 gold, double gold in San Francisco in 2023. Whiskey Masters again in 2023, and then double gold again in 2024. You're getting better and better. That's a lot of gold.
Yes. Yes. And I'll be honest, we don't chase awards, but when you get a silver, you go, oh, damn.
So close.
Yeah, must be that judge.
Now, Crafty asked me or said we need to ask you about your new blended.
Yes. Yes. So
tell us about the blended. He sent me a photo.
Yes, 36 South. 36 South is the latitude of the distillery, and it's a true blended whiskey. So everything is matured in our barrels. Obviously, I buy in a grain spirit side, but the grain spirit is bought in as grain spirit, whiskey spirit. It's got the right congeners in there, higher range for that. and then we cut it and we mature it in our own barrels. So the actual maturation is in our barrel houses, and it's matured using our knowledge of the barrels. What I then do is I take that as the base, and I do what we would do in a normal Scotch or other blended whiskey. I blend in some of my older and different malts to give it its flavor. It's really approachable, and because we've made a blend, it's really approachable on price, and that one is retailing around $70.
Yeah, $70 for 700 mil at 40%.
Yes.
Would that happen to be the new cellar door by any chance?
That is part of the new cellar door. I'm sorry, I think you've got either me or somebody in Ivy's in the background. yes, this is the new cellar door. The piece of wood you can see, which is the bar, is all from red gum, obviously the local tree, and that was one piece. This tree was amazing.
Wow. I love a large slab of wood like that. My dad's got he's kept for years, quite literally about 25 years, I think, these massive slabs of wood just in the back of the shed waiting to do something with them. Yes. He's held on to them through dozens of house moves.
My inheritance back in New Zealand is a big slab of curry. As a coffee, as a dining table. It's one big piece of dining table. So the whole table's made out of this one tree.
Well, we've got one of the tables, and there's two pieces of wire in it. And and it's right in the center of the piece of wood. And you can see where the tree has grown around these, because it's got the injury marks around where the two pieces of wire are. And the story is that was where the first European in the area actually put a wire around the tree to hold up a structure. Huh. And it literally has grown into the tree. And the wire is about that far apart.
Yeah.
And the tree is about that wide.
Oh, wow.
So
that's a lucky find, really.
Lucky
find. The other thing is, well, when you come up and visit us, you'll see the old boiler for the still. So nowadays, when you come, you can see the still through windows, and it's all obviously an hazardous area, and we're very careful and we do everything we can. Back in the 1930s, you could put a coal boiler next to the still.
Oh, wow. And okay.
We actually removed that coal boiler. And
why would you do that?
Why would we do that? And it wasn't in commission anyway, but it's actually outside, and it's got its own story as well. So that boiler previously was in an old paddle steamer which sank on the Mirror.
Oh, wow.
And they recovered the boiler out of it and brought it to the winery to power the still.
Wow. You've just got history upon history there.
We do. We're so lucky.
So given all that amazing back history of 100 years, where are you seeing Morris go in the next 10 to 15? What's on the horizon?
So one of the things I really would like to see is the people start drinking the fortifieds again. Mm-hmm. So fortifieds in Australia started falling off in the 50s, 60s, 70s. I'll be honest, the last person I know bought a glass of sherry in a pub was probably my grandmother, and she's been dead at least 20 years. Mm-hmm. So she's not been drinking very much, I'll be honest.
No.
And so fortifieds fell away. And one of the things about the whiskey is I get to use fortifieds and showcase what they can do to whiskeys.
Mm.
But what I'm hoping is the whiskey will bring in whiskey drinkers. And we are very unique. When you come to that cellar door, you can do something you can't do. We've Googled as much as we can, and we cannot find anywhere else on the planet where you can taste the whiskey against fortified, which developed that whiskey.
Yeah.
You can do a paired tasting.
It's pretty unique.
In a few years' time, you will be able to do it at the Port of Leith. In a few years' time, because they're not ready yet.
So at the moment,
but that I mean, that is fascinating. And
well, you can see the Port of Leith sitting there going, oh man, someone else already done it. Someone else already done it. We're onto a good thing here.
Australia.
Bloody Australians.
Fuck them.
So that is amazing.
Yeah. Being able to do that side by side is very special. Yeah.
And so in 15 years' time, what I'm hoping is that brings the whiskey drinkers into the fortified. And it is amazing to watch them taste some of the muskets and just watch their faces go, why didn't we know about this? And the reason you didn't know about it is my musket whiskey hadn't brought you into it.
Yeah, yeah. So more. So does that mean that you will be increasing production on the fortifieds, or is that you've got your back catalogue that you set? How much more do you need to lay down?
We lay down every year, and it's just juggling space and barrels and.
So how much every year is this vintage space do you have now?
In fortified, off top of my head, 2 million liters, something like that.
Whoa, far out.
Off top of my head, I can't be accurate because obviously it's all in wooden barrels.
Yeah, yeah. You should know every barrel off the top of your head there, really.
People that's take 100,000 litres. Yeah. Let's face it.
So the last barrel number I think was typed up was 4,021. So I don't know the name.
Ammo says their musket whiskey is lovely.
Oh, yes, it is.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Musket's not too bad either.
Do you reckon they know what they're doing with that?
What?
With their making?
Oh yeah.
They've done all right there.
They've done okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the one which won the old premium rare musket went in and won the Musket Du Monde. So the next year it went into the London Wine and Spirits Show, and we expected it to do well and win the Musket Award, and it did. But it went on to be voted the best fortified in all show. So it literally beat every sherry from Spain, every port from Portugal. It was the best fortified wine in the world.
Not allowed to call it sherry anymore.
Yeah. But then I love qualifying that by saying, but Gumamada Olives, which is a tiny little olive grove just down the road from us, and literally just down the road, as you go down Mia Mia Road, as you turn off, they're there. They won best Kalamata olive in the world that same week.
Really?
So for 1 week, a square mile of Victoria in outback Australia had two world's best.
Look, there must be something in the water there, honestly.
There's definitely something in the wine. So it's Catalaria as well. And we're very lucky. I've told you we've got a family. So Madden is now my winemaker. His dad, David, retired in February. David's dad, Mick, still comes in and does tastings. Yeah. Mick is now 96 years old. And the reason I say there's something in the wine is about 2 years ago, I was driving up Mia Mia Road, coming into work to check something on a weekend. And there was cattle loose on the road. And this ute screeched past me, sort of slid to an halt sideways, the door flung open, this fella jumped out and chases these cows up this hill, locks them in a field, and I get up to him, and it's Mick, he's 94 year old, he's just chased cows up the hill. Whatever he drinks, I'm drinking.
It's half fortified.
It's pickled, it'll last forever. That's brilliant.
Like my wife's mother. She's well pickled.
Yeah, lucky she doesn't listen, eh?
She's not listening anymore.
Definitely we will need to come back down to Brother Glen and drop in and have a look.
Last time
we got down, obviously, we do need another road trip. Absolutely.
But we need to plan it and say, Darren, we're on our way, as opposed to, hey, we're here.
If you actually give me some notice, I'll arrange that.
What's your definition of notice?
Well, what you could, but not 20 minutes.
Not 20 minutes. All right. All right.
So it's like going to Warbs Harbour and finding out they're closed on that day. Yeah. It's like, that... Hurry up.
Whoops.
It looks nice from the outside.
That's about as much notice as we gave my uncle when we rock up to his front door. We rock up to his front yard, my uncle in Rutherglen, and we went to see him because he's got a dinosaur in his front yard. Don't know whether you've heard about the dinosaur statue in the front yard of a street in Rutherglen. That's my uncle.
Yeah.
That's him. So I'd never been there before. I'd purely been told by my mum. My aunt bought my uncle this dinosaur, and we're in the car.
Yeah.
And I've got to.
Having just had a deflating experience at Morris because the distiller wasn't there.
Yeah. Which it might have been if you knew you were turning up.
So we're in the car and we're yakking away. We've got six blokes in the car, and the conversation turns to, you know how as an adult, no one ever asks you what your favorite dinosaur is anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is really disappointing. I mean, mine is a Velociraptor, just for knowledge. And I said to the guys, I can show you a dinosaur. And there were some gasps in the car, and Andy pipes up from the back, what, a real one? Like, you fuck with, yes, a real fucking one, of course. So just to prove it for you.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
There in Rutherglen, another claim to fame, there's a dinosaur in Rutherglen.
I thought that was going to be a picture of a petrol pump then and a bad joke.
I was going to bring up a photo of my uncle, but he's a different kind of dinosaur.
No, I have actually heard about the dinosaur.
There you go. So we literally, I brought that photo up. The GPS coordinates were on the photo because I'd never been to his house before. I'm just driving around based on trying to find the Apple Maps.
Oh, God.
We found it.
We did.
And, I thought I probably should knock on his door now, seeing as we're there. I didn't call him to say we were coming. I was like, oh, g'day, how you doing? Yeah. While you're here, I've got a problem with my computer. And that's what I do.
Yeah.
Been there 3 seconds, and he asked me to fix his computer for him.
Oh, don't. My dad was a coach builder, so he used to build trucks. So when it came to building things with his hands, he was brilliant. And we used to get invited to auntie called Auntie Lily. And as soon as we'd been invited to tea at Auntie Lily's, he'd go down to work and pack a toolkit. Because he knew when he got there was three or four jobs needed doing.
Already lined up.
I really empathize with him. Anyway, we digress.
We digress.
Your part of the world is a gorgeous part of the world, and there are many interesting things to see.
Many interesting
dinosaurs
things
to 100-year-old fortifieds. Oh. Obviously, you've got
we did get to have a look at the old barrels, didn't we?
Have a little look. The lovely lady, I can't remember her name, who showed us around and gave us a bit of a taster. Of the wines and the whiskies at the old tasting room, she was kind enough to show us into the bond store there, or the barrel room, a small part of it, and seeing those just glorious massive barrels there,
5,000 liter.
And all the aromas that come with that sort of old wood sitting there.
Sorry?
And the aromas that come from that sort of
walking in. Do you find yourself just walking in to the barrel rooms and just going, today's a good day?
That's why it's nice to have an holiday. Mm. Because sometimes you get too used to how good things are.
Yeah.
And then you go back and all of a sudden you can smell it again.
Mm.
It's not just the normal smell of work. And yeah. when you watch other people walking, especially when I do tours, and we're going to start doing cellar tours from the cellar door, so people will be able to walk through and see and smell that smell. And you see people who aren't used to it and just going, oh, wow. And you're like, yeah. oh, yeah, I've got to remember that.
It is something very, very special.
Mm.
The smells walking around Crafty's distillery are slightly different.
They're variable.
Yeah, yeah. But yours is quite nice.
But saying that as well, I know I've talked about Morris, but obviously I am Morris, and that's my passion and that's what I do. But if people do come down to the region, there's at least another 8 or 9 wineries to have a look around. And there's 3 or 4, 5 distilleries in quite easy striking range of it as well. So if you're into your distilleries and your wineries, Rutherglen is an amazing place to come. There's some definitely great there as well.
It would be quite a central place to sort of set up camp when you explored the rest of the region, really.
Exactly. And there's some beautiful beautiful hotel in Rutherglen, just been restored, the Victoria. Also, you're very close to Albury, so there's plenty of places to stay. But yeah, it's a lovely area.
Good pie time. Shop, from memory.
Good pie shop.
Pie shop in Rutherglen.
There is. Parker's Pies.
Yeah, it was pretty tasty lunch that day.
And come over to Corowa. Obviously, there's the distillery over in Corowa as well.
There is our friends down at Corowa there. And
you've got the Murray River and a bit of fishing and
absolutely. So obviously we've so Whiskey on the Murray is done for this year. Definitely stay for everybody listening at home. Get on the mailing list and get in for next year as soon as it is announced. Get your tickets to the dinner. That's always fan fucking tastic.
Yeah, it's getting bigger and better every year. So
I'm pretty certain they'll do another one next year.
I'm sure.
I can't imagine they'd stop it. But yeah, Whiskey on the Murray is definitely a thing to go and do. And just to explore around the whole Rutherglen region, it is an awesome place with lots to see, taste, and do. Darren, thank you for joining us.
Mm. Really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate you jumping.
We've been trying for a while. We've never quite got the ships to align.
The stars are aligned in a Melbourne hotel.
Unfortunately, Crafty Yes is unwell, and he didn't even jump on to post a comment. So he must be unwell, the poor Didum. So we'll raise a glass to Crafty.
So if it's mum flu, the old Yorkshire cure was whiskey and slightly warm lemonade.
Whiskey and slightly warm lemonade. And I was fed
that from 7 years old.
I'm going to bear that in mind.
His apricot jam and carrots for dinner probably set him off.
Hamo, yes, cool. Thank you for joining us. Thank you all. And Darren, hang around. We're going to play the sponsors. Please, everyone, hang around for them.
In a fortnight's time, we're speaking to Saverglass.
Yeah. Oh, that's in 2 weeks' time, is it?
2 weeks' time.
2 weeks, yes. So next episode in 2 weeks is Sally from Saverglass, which we were meant to be talking with her a couple of months ago and then jiggled around. So we've got her in 2 weeks' time to talk about all things glass
and packaging.
Glass and packaging.
Yep.
So I've got questions, and everyone who has questions about glass and Chinese glass, ask her about Chinese glass. I think she's got some thoughts.
Yeah.
So we'll talk to Sally in 2 weeks' time. And do we have after that?
I can't remember the week after that. No, not set up yet.
We do also have in 6 weeks' time, hopefully, something special happening at the Globe Hotel in Ralston.
Still a work in progress on that one.
Still, apparently it's locked in.
It's locked in, yeah.
But we'll see whether it actually happens, but we might have something exciting and interesting happening on the 21st of September, which is my birthday.
Watch this space.
Watch this space. We'll be announcing, hopefully, soon once we confirm that Crafty has actually locked it in, as he says he has. Yeah. Thank you all. Thank you, Darren.
There's locking things in. There's locking things in. Let's just put it that way.
That's it. jump on to morrisofrutherglen.com to get your bottles of everything, the wine, the fortifieds, the whiskey, and obviously get into to the new cellar door, which I'm very excited to come down and have a look at. Thank you all for joining us. Catch us again in 2 weeks' time.
Thank
Cheers.
You,
I finished my drink. Oh, my God.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Bonsai.
And we are...